Good afternoon, everyone. This is panel number 4302, U.S. Foreign Policy from the Outside Looking In. It is 12 p.m. on Friday, April 12th. My name is John Griffin. I'm the Faculty Director of the Conference on World Affairs. Let me apologize from the outset that we have an all-male panel. This panel was scheduled to have my colleague Megan Shannon as the moderator, but she fell ill, so I'm doing emergency duty for today's session. Pleased to have with us three accomplished speakers on this topic. I will introduce them in a moment, but first let me do a little bit of quick housekeeping. I'm reminded to remind you to please turn off any sort of alerts or reminders on your phones. The question and answer modes that we'll use for this session are now familiar to you, I'm sure. We will use the CWA app if you have that downloaded on your device. You just simply tap on, within the schedule, on this session title, and then tap Q&A, and type your message and send, and I will receive it immediately on my phone. If you prefer, you can submit questions via our note card system. There are some producers in the room. They'll be standing at the edges. Simply raise your hand, and they'll bring you a note card and a writing implement if you need it, and then raise your hand when you've completed writing your question, and they will pick it up from you and deliver it to me. Please remember to write legibly, or else it probably won't get asked. It definitely won't get asked.
It'll be a mistake.
If you're a student, please note that on the card or via the app, and I will give priority to those questions. Also, this session is being live streamed. Based on the information I'm receiving, there may be as many people viewing this online as are here. And it would be lovely to share with us if you are submitting a question via the app and you are doing so remotely, we'd love to know what your location is so that if your question is asked, I can share that information as well. Couple of other housekeeping measures. There is the Hill party that was scheduled for this afternoon has been canceled due to inclement weather, so please don't wander over to the Hill looking for that.
What?
You can come over to my house, Joe.
Yeah.
not all of you, just for sure. I'm a faculty member. My house is not that big. For those of you standing in the back, the session is being streamed into the tent outside, I believe, if you'd like to sit down. It is heated. If any of that is not true, just come back. Finally, there are still tickets available for the Molly Ivins plenary. It is a ticketed but free event, and those are available in the atrium downstairs. All right, well, let's begin. So again, we have three really well-positioned speakers to speak to today's topic. I'll just present them in this order. To my immediate left is Joe Serencioni, who will be familiar to many of you as a longtime contributor and valued participant in the CWA. Joe is the president of the Plowshares Fund, which is a global security foundation. I think I saw Joe on the Colbert Report or something,
yeah.
Some sort of fun show like that.
Yes.
For you students. So he is in your space.
In fact, if you look up Nuclear Colbert, you get me from that report.
Okay. No comment. So, To Joe's left is Bob Dreyfus, who some of you may also be familiar with from the CWA, was with us several years ago, and we're very pleased to have him back. Bob is an investigative reporter, written for a number of national publications, including Mother Jones Magazine, Rolling Stone, and others. And then to Bob's left is Ross Wilson, who is a career diplomat, was ambassador to Turkey and Azerbaijan, and is currently a distinguished senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I think that begins the, or that finishes the preliminaries. So this session will proceed as many of ours do, with introductory comments by the speakers on today's topic. Then I'll invite them to respond and interact with each other, and then we'll turn to the audience Q&A.
So let's begin with Bob. I've been designated to start. I find myself here at the center of a panel. It's unusual for me because I'm usually both literally and figuratively on the left of every panel that I've been at on this conference so far.
There's a spot down at the end if you want to go.
I may feel compelled to get up and move. I don't know. We'll find out in a minute. So this is a really interesting topic, and I really hope there's a lot of audience engagement on this thing. I don't know about you guys, but about 10:30 at night on election night, as I gazed at the New York Times app, which showed the percentage of who was likely to win, et cetera, I was hit by this question: what's wrong with me? How did I get this so wrong? At about 10:35, it was like, what's wrong with the country? Like, how did they get this so wrong? So around the world, though, and that's what we're here to talk about, right? As the sun rose in successive time zones and people woke up to the shock, I think that was a feeling that was like filed in triplicate by most of the people around the world, or as Arlo Guthrie said in Alice's Restaurant, accompanied by 34 8x10 glossy photographs. And I mean, people remember Alice's Restaurant, right? I mean, okay. Yeah.
This crowd.
Okay. So I think, you know, there was a kind of shock and awe, amazement, befuddlement, mixed with a little bit of schadenfreude and some humor about, you know, well, now we don't have to think about the United States anymore for a while. But I want to start out by saying that I think pretty much almost everything that Donald Trump is doing, has done, whatever, since January 20th, 2017, he told us he was going to do, or we could have kind of pretty much predicted it was going to happen. And I think that's true of everybody around the world, as weird as it is, right? So I just want to do a quick, in my first few minutes here, and we'll have lots of time to discuss it. Think about the stuff that happened. He said he was going to get out of the Iran agreement. He was persuaded not to for a little while, but then he did it. And he told us, he campaigned on that. It was the worst agreement ever made. He told us he was going to get out of the climate agreement. He did that. He said that he was going to do it. TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement that was semi-negotiated, and NAFTA, both, he got out of those. When the INF treaty came up with Russia, he got out of that. The reaction to all these things around the world was, okay, he told us he was kind of could do these things, but we didn't really, like, oh my God, he's actually doing it, right? And in the case of the JCPOA, you know, now he's sending his errand boys, like Secretary of State Pompeo and John Bolton and Vice President Pence, that noted Iran expert, around the world to tell the Europeans that not only are we glad we did this, but boy, you Europeans are getting in the way. You still want to trade with Iran. Like, how dare you try to get around our sanctions that we're doing? Okay, quick other things to say, and we can talk about all those things in the Q&A, and maybe my other panelists will come in on those things. Syria and Afghanistan, he wants to get out. He was kind of saying that along the way. And by the way, I agree with that. We should get out of Syria. We should get out of Afghanistan. I'm encouraged by the talks with the Taliban. I'm discouraged by the fact that too many Democrats jumped in and said, wait a minute, we can't get out of Syria. We can't get out of Afghanistan. Yeah, we can do that. But, of course, Trump is doing it. in the worst. He wants to get out of there in the worst way, and he's doing it exactly that, right? On Iraq, you remember he ran. Why didn't we take the oil and all that kind of stuff? And I'm sure he's still got in the back of his mind he wants to take the oil. Well, then he just recently said he wants to stay in Iraq in order to watch Iran. And I can tell you the Iraqis were not thrilled by that, because the Iraqis are very close to Iran. They have trade agreements. The president of Iran, Rouhani, just visited Baghdad. The prime minister, Abdelmahdi of Iraq, just went to Tehran. They're very close. There are a lot of overt and covert ties between the two. So they're not going to happy for us to stay in Iraq to watch Iran, quote unquote. So the Iraq, on Venezuela, he's talking about throwing the military around. I mean, seriously, the Monroe Doctrine should have died with President Monroe, but whatever it still is or represents, we have no business mucking around down there. It's a big mess. But and then on Iran, coming back to that for a second, this week was the latest outrage, declaring the entire Iranian military in the form of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps to be a terrorist organization. My own theory about what he's doing with Iran is he's trying to provoke the Iranians enough that they will pull out of their side of the agreement, and they might. Believe me, I've talked to Iranians about this. They're very serious. They feel like they've gotten nothing out of this deal. They gave up a huge amount of their nuclear program, and they're still screwed over by these sanctions. So there's a lot of pressure inside Iran. I hope they won't. I doubt they will, but it's not totally impossible. And if he's boosting the hardliners, is the point, in Iran. They have their own John Boltons over there who would like nothing to stick it to, you know, bore the stick it to the eye of the great Satan. And okay. Then what was his first trip overseas? You remember the glowing orb in Saudi Arabia? I mean, he's building an alliance with two of the worst leaders on the planet, Netanyahu and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And I mean, they don't really like each other, but they certainly both maybe hate Iran more than they hate each other. So you have the eminently qualified Jared Kushner going over there trying to make a deal. By the way, do people know that Bibi Netanyahu slept in Jared Kushner's bed when he was a boy? No kidding. The Kushner family, Charlie Kushner, the mobster who Chris Christie put in jail for hiring a prostitute to seduce his brother and taping it. No kidding. Bibi was a friend of the Kushners, and he used to visit them before he was prime minister, and Jared Kushner had to give up his bed, I don't know, maybe he was 10 years old or something, and go to another room so Netanyahu could sleep in his bed. And then I'm going to close on the kooky cast of characters that Trump has hired to connect us with the rest of the world. Not only Michael Flynn, but there's Felix Sater, you know him, the Trump Tower negotiator who once stabbed somebody in the face with a broken glass. There's Michael Cohen, who's now come around to from the dark side to I don't know what. George Nader, the guy who, you know, claimed to be the master negotiator between Russia and the United Arab Emirates and the Trump family. There's Eric Prince, the billionaire brother of our education secretary, who runs a paramilitary. I guess they can hear over there. Is Eric Prince on the panel next door? Is that? Who now runs a company called, I think, Frontier Services in Hong Kong, and wants to be the, you know, paramilitary world operator and run Afghanistan and everything else. There's Paul Manafort. We don't have to say anything more about him. And Steve Bannon, who's charging all over Europe trying to build a right-wing alliance of fascists from England to Greece and Italy and Poland. So the world is in shock. I think the world is in shock. And I'm in shock. I'm going to close by saying that so far nothing that Trump has done is as bad as the invasion of Iraq. So maybe we have something to be thankful for. That's it.
Thanks, Bob. Joe, would you like to go next?
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at this from the point of view of our allies, the victims of U.S. foreign policy, and our adversaries. How are they looking at this moment? I think our allies are still in a bit of shock. They're trying to make sense, trying to figure out a way to cope with the current U.S. foreign policy. You can see the kind of coping mechanisms they're developing by what they did around the 70th anniversary of the founding of NATO, the most successful national security alliance in history. Normally, this would be a time of great celebration, but they decided not to have a heads of state anniversary celebration because they didn't want President Trump coming to that event and making the kind of comments that he's made at previous gatherings of the Western Alliance, where he calls into question the very existence of the alliance, and it's the need for this. And this is because we have, as for the first time since the end of World War II, a president of the United States who doesn't see himself as the head of the Western alliance. He sees our European allies as economic adversaries, not as vital security partners. So they're trying to figure out how to get through the next 2 years. And a lot of what you hear from Europeans that many of us talk to is that they're waiting this out. And they're trying to decide after the elections of 2020 what America really is. Who was the anomaly, Barack Obama or Donald Trump? Because when Barack Obama was elected, they thought, here's the course correction. We're coming back from the George W. Bush deviation that thrust America into these new wars in the Middle East, that went on this adventurous, quest to establish militarily U.S. hegemony over the world. And they thought Barack Obama was returning to the kind of bipartisan Western partnerships that had existed before then. And then Donald Trump comes, and now they're thinking, no, this is what America really might be, and Barack Obama was the blip. So the jury's out for our allies. They're trying to cope and get through the next 2 years, and if Donald Trump's elected, there's going to be some major course corrections on the part of our allies, and you start hearing rumblings about it already. You hear, for example, Angela Merkel, what many people consider the true leader of the Western world at this point, talking about the need for Europe to look to itself. President of France making similar comments. It's time for Europe to take control of its own security. So pulling away from waiting for U.S. leadership. Europe is in no condition to do that. I mean, its political and security instruments don't correspond to the economic role Europe plays in the world, but there's a new urgency to further develop those. Let's take a look at the point of view of our victims. Since 9/11, almost 18 years now, we have expanded our military footprint dramatically around the world. We are now combating terrorism in over 80 countries. We have active bombing campaigns in 7 countries. We have troops in combat in 14 countries, and we have 40 foreign bases now dedicated to combating terrorism, all at the cost, according to a recent Brown University study, of about $6 trillion since 9/11. So $6 trillion that could have been gone to meeting our domestic needs is engaged in this war on terrorism. And that means that somewhere in the world, every day, it's likely that a U.S. bomb is killing someone. Now, maybe those people deserve to die. Maybe they've been attacking us, maybe they've been planning attacks on us or our allies, and they're enemy combatants, and they deserve to die. But a lot of innocent people die. Just a couple of weeks ago, we killed 8 Afghanis outside a hospital in Afghanistan, 5 children, a health worker, 2 security guards, and an unidentified body. And there's all too many of that. And for every person killed, combatant or non-combatant, somebody is mourning them. somebody's grieving for them, somebody wants to revenge that death. So our adversaries, and I'll close here, I'm a little over time. I think our adversaries are taking advantage of the U.S. strategy. If you're China, you see the United States in a very self-defeating course. I was just on a great panel about this yesterday. I mean, China is not pushing the U.S. off the world stage, but they are moving into the vacuum that we are creating by leaving it. So we pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm not saying that was a great trade pact, but it was a trade pact that had the U.S. playing a leading role. We pull out of it, China moves in with its own trade alignments. They're moving in now to create their own international financial arrangements to rival the World Bank and the IMF, instruments we created after World War II. That's part of our economic dominance in the world. They're moving in their One Belt, One Road strategy, for example, to extend foreign aid and their influence through many countries outside their territory, not militarily, economically, diplomatically, politically. Russia, the same. This is a subject of a whole other panel, but Russia's probably the greatest beneficiary of the U.S. strategy. Whether Trump is an agent of Russia or not, what he's doing, it perfectly aligns with Putin's goals. He is dividing the U.S. from Europe. He is dividing Europe. He is encouraging the rise of this white nationalist populism that is splitting European governments and other governments. So from Russia's point of view, this is near perfect for what they would like. Finally, just real quickly, some of the other countries we consider our adversaries, puny in comparison to Russia and China, but North Korea and Iran. North Korea would like to have a strategic alliance with the United States. The reason the deal fell apart wasn't because the North Koreans are wily and duplicitous. It's because of John Bolton's demands that North Korea unilaterally disarm before we would even consider lifting sanctions. From North Korea's point of view, they would like to have a new strategic relationship with the United States, one, to help modernize the economy, which is Kim Jong-un's number one priority now. He's a young man. He wants to rule that country for many years to come. He needs to modernize the economy. He needs Western aid. He needs the United States to do that. And two, as a strategic counterbalance to China. Historically, this is what Koreans have done, balance the great powers against each other. Iran would also like to have a reasonable relationship with the United States, like to have reasonable relations with the Western Europe, and Donald Trump is torpedoing that. So there are people we consider our adversaries actually have a desire to have a closer relationship to us than we sometimes realize. But this policy that we're now undertaking makes that nearly impossible. I'm going to just close with this. The results of this is that there is now in Washington, in Europe, and around the world, a new dynamism, a new discussion about what U.S. foreign policy is or should be. Just today, one of the centers we fund, the Center for New American Security, we give them a small grant, released a report on new voices on grant strategy. So younger people talking about this. One of them was a former student of mine, Kate Kaiser, and she wrote, "For better or worse, the past 2 years of Trump's presidency have created an opportunity for a significant course correction in U.S. foreign policy. It is time for a bold reimagining of the United States' role in the world based on an honest, unparalleled analysis of U.S. conduct since the end of the Cold War." And that's the new analytical moment that's opening up. This isn't about Trump, whether you like him or not, or Bush or Obama, whether you like him or not. It's what has the U.S. policy been? Has it been working? Is there some fundamental rethinking going on in the capitals of the world about the history of the past 70 years? Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Ross?
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. Let me begin by saying what a great honor it is to be included at this year's Conference on World Affairs, and how heartening it is in this very eclectic conference with lots of interesting and provocative topics that there's so many of you who've come to a session on American foreign policy. As a practitioner of American foreign policy for four decades, I take a lot of encouragement from your interest, and And I would strongly endorse the comments that Joe made there at the end about our the need for us to reappraise, reconsider what we're doing, where we want to go. And I hope that all of you can find ways to be part of that conversation. Joe and Bob have laid out a lot of specifics, and I thought it might be useful for me to just go up a little bit in altitude and talk about some of the broader pieces that I think are relevant for your understanding or for our understanding about how America and how American foreign policy are viewed in the world. And partly at a mass level, where there is some very good data, also at a kind of government elite level, where I have some impressions gleaned from having worked in this field for a while, and then talk a little bit about what are some of the things that the United States ought to be trying to do and think about building off of Joe's very good comments. The best source of information about global attitudes on the United States is the annual Pew Global Attitudes Survey that looks, the most recent one and published in October last year, polls extensive polling in about 60 different countries around the world, gives you a real good snapshot of how we are seen, how our leaders are seen, and more or less how our foreign policy is seen. 50% of those polled worldwide have a favorable view. Favorable is kind of a vague word, but a favorable view of the United States, 43% unfavorable. These numbers down fairly significantly from where they were in the Trump administration. They're not at all the Obama administration, not at all inconsistent with the numbers of the Bush administration or the Clinton administration that came before. More telling, and this picks up from what my colleagues have said, a mere 27% of those polled express confidence in the President of the United States. 70% no confidence or do not have confidence in the President of the United States. Comparably. And both of these figures, where the scores, and actually all that I will run through, the scores are lower, tend to be in Europe, to some extent in the Middle East, except for Israel. They're higher, the favorability and the confidence in the President of the United States, much higher in Asia, and significantly higher in Africa. The Asia piece, reflecting off of what's been a topic of a number of other conversations at this conference, China. 26% believe that the United States, in its foreign policy, takes into account the interests of other countries. 70% believe that we seldom take into account the interests and perspectives of other countries. Those numbers actually haven't changed for the last 20 years. They're in that range at any rate. And that reflects there's something broader that's going on at this 10,000-foot altitude, at least, broader than just the things that my colleagues have put on the table, although those are serious matters. So turn to the governments, and here it's a little bit more impressionistic on my part. What do I see and what do I hear when I talk to people? What do I hear when I read accounts in the newspapers? One is a great deal of uncertainty about the United States, a concern about American inconsistency, and about polarization. And I've heard this just quite recently in the Caucasus area of the former Soviet Union. They look at Republicans, Democrats duking it out, and they don't know how to position themselves. They don't know what's going on. They don't understand this. And to the extent that they do, they don't like it. Second, and this follows from the first, what foreigners see, I think, is bickering. It is ineffective governance. reflected in the fact that we can't pass a budget on anything like the time frame where it's required. We have long-term government shutdowns. We have ineffective policies. We seem, in the eyes of too many of our partners, not to have clear and conscious strategies. And a kind of bickering and infighting that we never tolerated during the Cold War. For some real good reasons, we seem to have it be beset by it now. Third, I think foreigners see us much more preoccupied, see Americans in America much more preoccupied with themselves and with this country. In a sense, that maybe isn't a bad thing. But they also see in that America more preoccupied with itself what we could charitably perhaps refer to as a much more pugnacious American policy. And that, too, is not just this president. All of these things that I'm describing, they have all been there for the last 10, 15, 20, 25 years. I sat in a discussion in the middle of the Clinton administration led by Deputy Secretary Talbot. All of those things were talked about. They're not new. Some of the specific concerns are, and they're real, and I don't want to belittle them, but I think that's important. And the fourth thing that one sees among foreigners are two quite contradictory perceptions that I would highlight. One is a sense that the United States is in retreat globally, and the other that we're over-militaristic and overextending ourselves, what Joe talked about. It's like, well, those are like separate. Those are different things. But that you hear a lot of that when you go around the world. Go back to the Pew poll, and I'll close with this. Both the governments that we deal with, that I deal with, and the publics in the revealed in these Pew polls look for and want American leadership. When asked, what country do you believe would you want to see lead in the world? 63% say the United States. 63%. And that's last fall. That isn't 5 years ago. But to me, that's quite interesting. 19% say China. And I did the math before I came over here. 19% of the world's population, that would be China. And again, to repeat something I said earlier, the highest percentages were more American leadership sought in Asia. 81% of Japanese in the 70s for the Philippines, but South Korea, Australia, but also Sweden, Canada, the Netherlands. 70%+ looking for more American leadership. How do we address these things? Well, again, I'll stay at the 10,000 foot altitude. One I think important, some of the kind of sniping that's reflected in the general and longer term things. This comes at the territory. The more often when we lead, we generate resentment. When we don't lead, we generate resentment. And so some of that is just sort of there. Noise is bad. The noisiness, the boisterousness, the contentiousness, the bickering, the infighting, the tweets. These things, they confuse foreign audiences about what we are, about what we want. They look disturbing. They want results. And I think that would be a second observation. Democrats have to succeed at governing. Democrats with a small d have to succeed at governing. We're not seen as succeeding at governing. We're not seen as succeeded in leading around the world. And I think those are difficulties for us. We have to get our own house in order. And that's been a theme in a number of the foreign affairs panels that I've been in. There are important things that are not right and that are widely seen as not right in American foreign policy. There are a whole lot of things on the domestic side that are also a little out of kilter and will be important for us to find our right way in the world and to lead effectively. Thank you.
Nexus wanted to give the speakers an opportunity to react to anything anyone else said, to agree, disagree, ask a question.
Well, I have a question, Ross. You served around the world, and I want to go a little deeper into this question of what other countries' attitudes are towards America, and to sort of check my own perception of this. I mean, I think that, and the poll somewhat reveals that. Particularly in the West, there's still a deep well of goodwill for America. That people like Americans and they like America. As some people say, you're not a lot of people clamoring for a Chinese passport. You know, this is where they want to go. And there seems to be somewhat of a disconnect between their view of America and Americans and our government and our foreign policy. And you know, it seems that our foreign policy is out of step with the kind of desire of the American people for more values-driven approach to foreign policy, a less military approach to foreign policy. But I'm wondering if you've seen people make that distinction and try to reconcile what their view of America with their view of American foreign policy.
Yeah, what I tend to hear is maybe less explicit recognition of what you're describing. But certainly, when I was serving in Turkey in the relatively immediate aftermath of the American invasion in 2003, was we like America, we like Americans, we're kind of okay about the government. We don't like what you're doing in Iraq. 90% of the Turkish public opposed the invasion, and 90% of it still thought it was a bad idea 3, 4, 5 years later. Even though the government kind of came around and cooperated with the government, found ways to support what we were trying, what was U.S. government policy at the time. But anyway, separating those pieces, it's not just Americans versus the government. It's Americans versus the government versus specific actions that they find available. In Georgia, where I'm serving presently, there is overwhelming pro-American sentiment. There is overwhelmingly pro-American government sentiment. There is overwhelmingly pro-American policy sentiment among the public and among the larger citizenry. So it ends up being kind of a mixed picture depending on where you are.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I was thinking when you were talking about the Pew survey, that if Trump saw that 70% of the people think he's doing a bad job, he would take that as an enormous positive reinforcement, because he knows quite well that he's a provocateur and he doesn't have any intention of pleasing the rest of the world. Right? Like, that was a great report card for me. If I can get it up to 90%, I'll get reelected. I have a question for Joe about NATO, but I want to say, first of all, about this question about that John asked about how people perceive us. I spent a few trips in Iran. When I went to Iran, I wore a hat that said New York on it because I wanted everybody to know I was American. I don't have time to describe at length the amazing stuff I learned, but I will say that I talked to literally hundreds of people in Iran, on the street, everywhere, in different hundreds of people. They love Americans. They wanted to talk to me. They couldn't. They saw my New York hat and they wanted to come talk to me. They would say to me, "I hate the mullahs," or they'd say to me terrible things about their own government. It was very hard to find people who will say praiseworthy things about the Iranian government. On the other hand, when it comes to the American government, they were to the left of me. Right? Here's a country surrounded by American troops in Afghanistan, in Iraq, a NATO ally in Turkey, an American fleet in the Persian Gulf, clashes at sea. We shot down one of their airliners. They're not happy about the American government. So there's a complete and utter disconnect in terms of the way the Iranians. My question for Joe is about NATO.
Yeah.
Talk about reappraisals. Now look, in 1990 or so, we told the Russians If you will let these two Germanys come together to make one big Germany and have it be part of NATO, we're not going to move anymore into Eastern Europe, and we're not going to expand NATO, and we're not going to do any of this stuff that you worried about in Moscow. And then Clinton came in, and then Bush came in, and all of a sudden NATO went from whatever it was to like 30-some countries now, or I don't know, whatever. This was one of the dumbest, stupidest, dumb mistakes we've ever made. Expanding NATO into Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia now, whatever those countries are named, and the various breakup parts of Yugoslavia, and then trying to get Georgia and Ukraine to join. This is like poking the bear, not only in its, well, I wouldn't say what orifice we poked it in. And we told them we wouldn't do this. And no wonder that Russian nationalists got mad. Yes. And no wonder that Vladimir Putin interfered in our election in 2016. Because we're going into their backyard and we're saying we want to be the big boss of your backyard. Now, I would say, I'm taking up my place on the left of this panel, even though I'm sitting in the middle of it. We don't need NATO anymore. It should have been dissolved when the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. We don't need NATO except as an outlet for American military industrial manufacturing companies that want to sell planes to Georgia and communication systems to Slovakia and all this other kind of stuff. We're not going to. Trump said something that was really like freaked everybody out, right? Remember when he was running, I think he said, those people in Montenegro, they're pretty aggressive. And if they like provoke Russia, are we going to go to World War III over Montenegro? Well, I want to ask you guys that question. My answer is no. So, we shouldn't arm Ukraine. That's like a big mistake. And people criticized Trump during the Republican convention. Oh, well, you kowtowed to Russia, so you purged this thing about arming Ukraine lethally. Well, yeah, Obama didn't arm Ukraine lethally. That was not some radical pro-Russian thing. That was Obama's administration policy not to arm Ukraine. So I want to start, and that doesn't mean NATO has to be dissolved tomorrow, but we need to start thinking about what do we need this giant military alliance for when we don't really have an enemy anymore. And we don't need a $733 billion defense budget. I would say we could cut it by a third, not little increments, right? We could close half of our 800 bases overseas. So let's start thinking about that when we think about reappraisal.
So there was a question in there for me? What do I think of that?
Why do you like NATO so much?
I think the main headline to take away is that Bob Dreyfus agrees with Donald Trump on NATO.
Almost.
So I run a foundation called Plowshares Fund. And one of our advisors, and now a personal advisor, is former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry. And he was there during the expansion of NATO and favored the expansion of NATO. He now thinks of it as the single greatest mistake. That we basically mistook something we could do for something we should do. And there was a desire on the part of these Eastern European countries to come into NATO. They were worried about Russia, understandably.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to know much about history to know that for generations Russia has dominated these countries in one form or the other. And there was some desire in the Western Europeans to do this as well, although the Germans in some ways were the most reluctant, given the difficulties they had in incorporating East Germany into the new United Germany. But it was something we could do. We had the mechanisms for it. It's something we're well suited for. And so we did it. Without really thinking how Russia was going to react to this, more precisely, ignoring how Russia would think about this, because they were a weak, defeated country, because we were in a triumphalist mood. We won the Cold War. So there are two things. The Russians always resented that attitude, because they felt like, wait a minute, we got rid of the Soviet Union. We got rid of the Warsaw Pact. You know, we're the ones who decided this. Why do you think you defeated us? Right. You know, and so there's always this Russian view of this resentment towards this American triumphalism, which all the presidents held you know, since 91. The foreign policy elite hold it to this day. You still hear it. We won the Cold War. And the second part was when I first started going to Russia, it was only in the 90s, the far-right ultranationalist wing of the in Russia, the political spectrum of Russia, had this mantra about how this was a, there was a master plan in America. You know, first they got rid of the Warsaw Pact, then they got rid of the Soviet Union, now they're coming from Mother Russia. And goddamn, everything we did justified that narrative, including moving military forces right up to their borders. You know, not standing down NATO.
Bombing Serbia,
and everything justified. And now that is the dominant view in Russia. That is Putinism. That there is a master plan to take them down. That we are interfering in their affairs. I'm not justifying Putinism. I think he's one of the greatest threats to freedom and democracy around the world. But you have to understand what his base of support is and why the Russians think that. Why they will support a leader like Putin. So this is part of what I mean when there's now the first shoots of a rethinking of overall Cold War policy. You know, of not accepting this as this was a success story. Because look at where we are now. And not seeing it as just a problem of Trump, of this particular president. Because he hasn't deviated all that much from U.S. foreign policy, aside from questioning the Western alliance, questioning this, engaging in a general sort of nationalist isolationism. But the policy is still fairly continuous in general with what we've done over the last 75 years. The big fear, and then I'll stop here, is to think about which way we're going now. If you look at the 75 years since World War II, the first 35, the U.S. foreign policy, you know, sort of, I wonder what you think about this, sort of basically acted like we were still fighting World War II. We almost immediately engaged in another major land war, this time in Asia, the Korean War. That was a disaster. And then we followed it almost immediately with another major land war in Asia, Vietnam. But it was still this World War II type combat operations. We then stopped that. And the next 40 years, we did not engage in major wars. We had some wars, but they were relatively short duration, intervene, pull back. And what some people worry about is now with Trump, we're about to re-engage since Bush, with the Iraq War. We're now back into this mode, and there's a fear that Trump now wants to continue that, or more precisely, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and some people in the Trump administration believe they can push Trump into a new war with Iran, a new major combat
unless John Bolton gets his rabies shot, then...
What do you mean? No, so... So I'm just so back to you. Are we at that kind of pivot point where we may be at the verge of engaging in another major war?
I'm very worried about Iran. I think Iran is the, more than North Korea, I think Iran is the place. I just wrote a big piece about this a few weeks ago. There are like five flashpoints that could erupt into a hot war between the United States and Iran, and I'll just name them really quickly. Israel is bombing Iranian forces in Syria with our support and letting the Russians and the Syrians know that we're only targeting, that is, they're only targeting the Iranians. There's potential clashes in the Gulf among the navies, and Trump has said, why don't we just sink those Iranian fast boats that sometimes, remember there was an incident where American troops were seized and then released thanks to Obama's diplomacy. Trump might react differently. He said he wants to use Iraq as a place to watch Iran, and according to the New York Times reporting, they've actually developed a plan to attack Iran, to shoot cruise missiles or whatever, if because the Iranians have fired some random rockets into the green zone, and by the way, killed no one. It wasn't the Iranians who were doing this. I'm sorry, it was the maybe pro-Iranian militias or something. There's a lot of fighting still going on in Iraq. There's several other flashpoints around Balochistan and some of the terrorism that has erupted. We support now the MEK. I have a photograph on my phone of Rudy Giuliani at a recent mission, a meeting of the Mujahideen al-Halq, which is the Iranian opposition terrorist group. It was on the U.S. Yeah. terrorism list until 2012, when Obama took them off as a way of trying to get Iran to like us so we could do the deal that he did. Trump has now pretty much aligned with them, and they conduct terrorism inside Iran. They kill Iranian people. There's a whole bunch of... So, yeah, any one of these things could erupt into a war. And I've talked to people who've seen the classified plans for what it would mean if the United States attacked Iranian nuclear facilities. There are like 53 sites. You know this better than me, Joe. There are like 53 sites in Iran where the Iranians had formerly the whole nuclear program, right? It would not just be a lightning strike. It would be 2 weeks of intensive bombing of Iranian air defense systems so we clear the skies, and then 6 more weeks of intensive bombings of these sites, including repeat hits on sites that are hardened, until we feel like we've destroyed the whole Iranian program. Tens of thousands of people would die in this thing, and by the way, it would not end there, right? This was the beginning of a conflict, not an end. So could that happen before the 2020 election? Man, I mean, maybe.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. I know Ross wants to interject, and then I'd like to turn to the audience Q&A after that.
Sure. I just want to make a couple of points on... I think historians may well look back at... need to examine the matter of NATO expansion, to what extent Secretary of Defense Perry's sentiments are well-based and well-founded. The point is, it happened.
Yeah.
And a retreat now, an abandonment of countries that have allied with us and that are now engaged with us. Many of us in this room concerned about American leadership in the world. If we want there to be less of it, then we try to undo that particular piece of history. On one detail Bob mentioned, we did not tell the Russians that NATO would not expand to the east. There was never a commitment like that. The Russians have alleged that there was. There wasn't. There was a clear understanding that NATO would not permanently station forces in east of Germany, which in fact has not happened. I think there's an important distinction there that I thought was important to refute. The weapons that have been provided to Ukraine and to Georgia are defensive weapons. Their function is, for example, to go after Russian tanks, Russian armored personnel carriers, to shoot down Russian aircraft, for example, the kind that have attacked in Ukraine over the last several years, that carried out a vicious and wide-ranging set of attacks against Georgia in 2008. Certainly in the case of Georgia, it's a kind of hedgehog strategy. Make it difficult and costly for Russia if they try to do this again. For the Georgians defend themselves. It isn't the United States. They're not treaty allies any more than the Ukrainians are. On the matter of Iran, I get the concerns, and certainly Bob has highlighted a number of them about why we ought to be concerned about what may happen. Iran is doing things too,
yes,
that add to the danger, and we got to be cognizant of that as we think about what are the wise and sensible secure courses for the United States and for our interests in the region. And oh, by the way, Russia is also on the move and doing obnoxious things in the United States with respect to our election, in Europe with respect to countries that are our friends and allies that look to us for leadership and have been disappointed, in places like Georgia and Ukraine. And those are real material threats. And our security, our defense policies, our foreign policies, including what our diplomats do, it isn't all about guns, need to take that into account and need to find ways to counter it.
Thanks, Ross. So turning to the audience questions, I'd like to elaborate on a question that I received, which is as follows. Why are there no foreign guests on this panel? So those of you that have been at CWA before might know that we have had panels titled or organized similarly on this question, in which the panelists were everyday folks from other countries that would share with us their impressions of the U.S. I remember Cyril Ami was on one of those panels, for example. She wasn't singing. She was sharing with us her impressions as a French citizen. So to elaborate on that, and this engages with, I think, the, you know, for example, the Pew study that Ross mentioned. We focus on the impressions of the U.S. at the mass or average citizen level. Why do we do that? Like, why does Pew poll average citizens in other countries about their impressions of the U.S.? It's a natural human impulse to want to be liked. What are the consequences of citizens, average citizens in other countries, not having a favorable impression of the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of democracies around the world that that have to be responsive to the views of their electorate on how they conduct their foreign defense and security policies. Mm-hmm. And even in countries that aren't democracies, public opinion matters, and leaders have to take that into account. Mm-hmm. I think it's been a central tenet of American foreign policy going back to the beginning of the Cold War to try to build everyday relationships with everyday people, winning hearts and minds. That's kind of become a maybe not the best phrase to use anymore, but that was behind a whole series of public diplomacy programs, exchange programs, libraries that we had all over Europe and other parts of the world to build relationships and that people understand us and have an open and reasonably friendly approach toward the United States. I think it's any American government that isn't working on those things is making a big mistake. We have been substantially cutting our funding for these activities for the last 20 years.
Yes.
And to some extent, these numbers that aren't good reflect that.
Thanks.
Just one quick point. This is exactly right. And this is actually a thread you see in some of the critiques of American foreign policy overall, over Democrats and Republicans, is that we're missing this dimension. We focus too much on military relationships, on head state relationships, and we've cut back on the kinds of libraries we used to have in posts around the world. It's not, I mean, I remember this. The U.S. embassies used to have these very open sections of it, and especially since 9/11. And the security around U.S. embassies has really cut off access of to these facilities, to these kinds of libraries and cultural events that used to be a mainstay of an embassy's or presence. When's the last time I heard somebody talk about the Peace Corps? You know, and we all remember when the Peace Corps was one of the finest symbols of American involvement in the rest of the world. And so what I'm hearing,
it still is.
How much do you hear about it? What's the funding for the Peace Corps? And when's the last time the president mentioned the Peace Corps?
Oh.
You know, what you're seeing, especially among the younger people who are starting to comment on this, is a desire to get back to those kinds of people-to-people relationships between America and the rest of the world, and less of the military and heads of state relationships.
And how are those impressions of America formed? You both referred to diplomatic efforts to improve attitudes towards the U.S., and we're not the only countries that does that. China does it in the U.S., for example, try to improve favorable impressions of China. But we might think of those efforts as quite different, or in terms of how we might judge them. Do average citizens in other countries form judgments about the U.S., or do we want them to form judgments about the U.S. based on our policies or based on our efforts to our public relations efforts to get them to like the U.S.
Well, I want to say something about that. I think one of the big things we're going to see playing out over the next generation or so is the worldwide competition in public opinion and elsewhere between what we can call, for the sake of argument, the American model and the Chinese model. And though many people may not want China to lead the world, as Ross explained earlier, there are countless people around the world who look at what China's economy has been able to do over the past 30 years, in which China, despite having no freedom, no semblance of democracy, no freedom of expression, etc., which is part of their model, yet they've lifted 600 million people in their citizens of their citizens up from subsistence level living or less to working class, middle class level of existence. If you look at the UN Millennium Development Goals, which were signed a number of years ago, and people alleviating from poverty, something like 90 or 95% of those are in China. So in Asia, in people in India, for instance, in Africa, where China's Belt and Road thing is beginning to spread, there are a lot of people who look at that and say, well, we don't really need democracy. Look what China did, right? They've developed, but we're scratching out our existence in Tanzania, and I've been there and I've seen it. You know, after the crash of 2008, when American capitalism was seen globally as having failed, right? And by the way, it didn't really impact China. They had a drop in exports, but they pump primed their economy and they did fine. And so people, I guess what I'm saying is, if we're going to let millionaires and billionaires run this country, as the senator famously says, and if we're going to allow the kind of economic uber class to run this country, then that's not going to be a happy model for the rest of the world to look at. So I want America to hold up itself as the model for the world, not based on how powerful we are, not based on our military power, not based on our alliances, but on the fact that we can grow and prosper and develop and spread a version of not just democracy, big D, but little D democracy, in terms of equality and opportunity and ending racism and sexism and all of those problems that exist in this country. And that should be the model that we show the rest of the world. And people will start looking to that. And they won't look to China anymore. They won't see China as the leader.
I would just echo this with a somewhat simpler way of putting it. Democrats have to succeed at governing and leading, or someone else will take their place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. See, another question here, kind of relating to Bob's comment on Trump's optimal level of approval of the U.S. What's the optimal support for U.S. policies or attitudes towards America that we want to see abroad? Is it 100%?
As I tried to suggest in my semi-prepared remarks, I think some of that negativity goes with the territory, and whether it's President Trump, who's seen as a disruptor by many around the world that people get aggravated about, or a different president that's leading, pushing, cajoling, demanding of others certain things, either one of those generates a certain amount of resentment among foreign governments, and even more so finds reflection often in the local media, not countered always effectively by the United States or by the U.S. and its allies, maybe stoked by disinformation that comes from Russia or China or other quarters. We have to recognize that's part of the mix. I think we thought in these debates that I referred to in the 1990s with Secretary Talbot, we came to the conclusion we couldn't be too mesmerized by those numbers. They shouldn't drive our policy decisions. We have to figure out what's the right and necessary thing to do it and succeed at it, and the rest would follow along. But those numbers are not, they're not nothing, and they're not something to ignore at all.
Yeah, we'd love to have 100%, right? But think, here's Donald Trump, who refers to countries in Africa as shithole countries. You can imagine, you don't have to imagine, you can Google it, how the African media reacted to that comment and how African leaders reacted to that comment. On the other hand, George W. Bush, not my favorite president, got a huge amount of credit. Why? Because he took on the question of HIV and AIDS in Africa and developed a very important program which was brilliantly successful, and not perfect, but which had tremendous success in reducing what had become an almost unimaginably bad crisis in countries like Zimbabwe and other, in Kenya, Uganda, etc., South Africa. So what does that tell you about the success of that program? Now, if you go to the UN and you do the tour, you'll see there's a chart there that shows the world military budget. If it's now, it would be approximately $2 trillion plus. And then next to it has a chart that's showing what you could accomplish with certain amounts of money. And I think I remember that it said for $60 billion, we could provide the entire world with access to clean drinking water. And then other steps that could be taken too, right, in terms of ending infectious diseases and a whole bunch of other things. I'm not saying the United States should take this responsibility on, but we could certainly be a leader in taking on the problem of infectious diseases, of clean drinking water, of all the other things that afflict those shithole parts of the world, as our president would call them. And we would get enormous credit, and we would be close to 100% if we started to lead a world effort through the UN and through other agencies on questions like that, as opposed to, you know, trying to sell them weapons.
Student question. How important do you think attitudes towards the U.S. are, or attitudes towards the U.S. are to the U.S. electorate? Is it an effective campaign strategy for a candidate to say, people around the world don't like us?
Let me, very good question. As you'll notice, foreign policy and even national security issues are a small part of the presidential campaigns. Most of the discussions, most of the speeches the candidates have given have been all about domestic issues or about the President of the United States, as opposed to laying out yet a vision of what their foreign policy should be. But however, this particular point of what the rest of the world thinks of us, I think it does have saliency for the American electorate, because we're a very proud people. We think we are the greatest nation in the world, and it does hurt our pride to find out that other people don't think that, and think that in some cases that we're one of the greatest danger in the world. That it's very jarring. And so you want to elect a president who, you know, embodies a renewal, embodies a sort of an enlightened patriotism that can fulfill your ideal of what you think our country is. And if it's in the election, I think if it's an effective critique of the Trump administration would be that Donald Trump is dragging down the image and credibility and legitimacy in the world around us. I think in that sense, it will matter to the American, does matter to the American electorate what the rest of the world thinks of us.
Yeah, hope so.
Any response?
Nothing.
Anybody else? Okay. And as a last question, just in general, what are foreign or international reactions at either the mass or elite level to just general U.S. isolationism. You know, if the U.S. continues to withdraw, both in terms of more charitable activity as well as less charitable activity, what's the reaction to that?
Let me just start while you guys are thinking. I'll talk while I'm thinking.
Go ahead, confess.
Get to the microphone first. One of my mentors is Madeleine Albright, and she had coined the phrase that almost everybody knows, that the U.S. is the indispensable nation. And I'm not sure that's true, but I do see that other countries want the United States involved. That's not the issue. It's not like other countries are pushing us out. They want us to stay in NATO. They want us to stay in the United Nations. They want us back in the climate accord. They want us back in the Iran anti-nuclear deal. All the things that we're leaving, they want us back. They don't want us back in a bullying, militaristic way. They want us back in the way that that we think and that they think we're supposed to be, this enlightened, value-driven, democratic with a small d, foreign policy, where we see our partners as equals in this endeavor. Where, yes, we're leading, but we're leading with them. We're not leading against them. We're not leading despite them. And so people want us engaged in the world, and they need us engaged. I can't think of a major global issue that can be resolved if the United States stays in the sidelines, whether it's climate change or nuclear weapons or pulling the rest of the world out of extreme poverty or the pandemics, promoting democratic values, resisting authoritarian regimes. You need the United States in that, but you need a better United States than what we've got right now.
Yeah. Any other closing thoughts? We're out of time.
I agree. And when you travel around the world, what's amazing is how closely every other country follows our politics. I mean,
yeah.
You go to Asia or Africa, or I was just in Sweden. I mean, people know who the deputy, you know, they know Mitch McConnell. They know, could anybody name any politician in Sweden? Or, I mean, no, you can't. I know you can't.
Carl Bildt.
I mean, it's just they follow everything. In Vietnam, in Iran, they know the names of our, you know, third-tier people. So
right.
They can.
Yeah, and they're watching.
Last word, Ross.
One of the earlier sessions, I think on the first day, was, and Joe was part of this, on global hegemony and competition, great power competition. I think the rise of great power competition and the increased assertions by Russia, largely by Russia, to some extent by China, are a reflection of what is seen as American retreat or isolationism, and retreat that isn't just this administration. Although it may have been pushed along significantly by it in the way it's perceived, but has some longer pieces. So I think Russia, China, absolutely taking advantage. I think a second point I'd make, in Europe there is, at least what I see, is renewed interest in, not so much in the European Union, but in European defense and security. For years, a number of the European governments have kind of been freeloaders. That's what the burden-sharing argument has been about. It predates President Trump, and both Chancellor Merkel and President Macron talking about the need for Europe to get a grip on its own security and be more prepared and capable itself of dealing with security and related foreign policy problems. That may give rise to some concerns in Washington, but it's basically a healthy thing. It follows from the reconstruction of Europe that we did so much to support in the 1940s and the 1950s. The last thing I'd say is one of the things I think America needs is, and it reflects off of what my colleagues have said about over-militarization of American foreign policy. We need more diplomacy in American foreign policy. We're kind of out of practice, especially when it comes to diplomacy among equals, because we really haven't had to do that since about 1942. But we got to work on that skill set. We got to work on the personnel base, ensure that there are resources, ensure that we're not shorthanded at senior levels as we are now, and put diplomacy back in the center of American foreign policy, not our well-qualified, talented, sharp, capable men and women in uniform. God bless them, but we need those other parts as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Class dismissed.
Yes. Thank you. Have a good rest of the day.